need to say this regularly. I appreciate it. Jennifer's able to be here and Judy's able to be here. It lets me think a little bit more about what I'm doing now and it's about trying to organize and lead this part, and I do thank you for that. I also want to tell you that although I did have a couple of cookies in celebration of the WMU anniversary, I have been trying to walk on my treadmill, and I have a piece of consumer safety to share with you. I have fixed up a little line that brings the sound from the television that's sitting near there to earplugs so that I don't have to turn the sound up so loudly that the wakes up the rest of the family if it's early in the morning or that the neighbors complain. And the wire, if I don't put it, sort of wrap it around the top of the treadmill, it falls off and pulls the things out of my ears and all these kinds of things. So I have it wrapped around like this. And I was on the treadmill, and I'm on the treadmill. I usually have it set to 3 or maybe 3.2 or 3.3, which is ambling gait at best, but it does give me an elevated heart rate, which is what you want. And the wire wasn't quite in the right position. And so I went to adjust the wire, and with this finger, I think it was, I brushed number 7. I did have the safety piece on. I wasn't clear-minded like Dennis was. It did not occur to me to just pull it loose. Instead, I'm flailing away trying to get it under control. And I simply want to tell you, if you want to see what happened, it wasn't captured on YouTube, but something was captured on YouTube that's pretty much the same thing. So if you go to YouTube and enter polar bear treadmill, look at that video. That's pretty much what happened to me that day, and I really think that all of you should see that.
Oh, that's not fun.
Okay, now back to this. If you would turn, please, to 2 Kings chapter 6, and as you're looking there, what I need is for those of you who haven't been here for the last couple of weeks, those of you who have, I need you to just real quickly set the stage for this. Back in 1 Kings, Elijah had a confrontation with the false prophets, the prophets of Baal on top of Mount Carmel. God answered with fire. It was clear who was God and who wasn't God. The prophets of Baal were killed, and Elijah had his greatest triumph. And that same day, Jezebel said, I'm going to kill you about this time tomorrow, and he runs for his life. After the end of this process of running, where God has sustained him, helped him, fed him, encouraged him, he for the second or third time says, God, I'm completely alone. I'm the only one left. And just before God says, there's at least 7,000 that are still with you. You are not alone by any means. In that moment, it's in 1 Kings 19, God gives him a very specific, surprisingly specific assignment. 3 parts to it. Now, you're supposed to remember those 3 parts. If you haven't been here for a couple of weeks, you're off the hook. But if you've been here the last couple of weeks, you're supposed to remember those 3 parts. What was the assignment? What was number 1? Number 1 was, you're supposed to go find Elisha and make him your servant apprentice so that he can be successor after you. Okay? And that has now happened. By the time we get to this point in 2 Kings, Elijah has been taken up to heaven in a fiery chariot and a whirlwind. That's gone. But those assignments back there, only one of them has been taken care of. And that is, Elisha was his servant. Elisha has become his successor. And so now Elisha is the prophet. And if you remember our charts, Elijah and Elisha were both from and working in the northern kingdom, which is Israel, not so much the southern kingdom, which is Judah, although there's overlap in the discussion in the Bible of what they did. Okay? What were the other 2 assignments? Number 1 was to appoint a new king in Aram. What is Aram? Where is it located? That's modern day Syria, so it would be north and east of Israel. So sort of the other side of the Sea of Galilee and back up in there. What's its capital city? Damascus, bravo. Okay. The current king is Ben-Hadad, and who's supposed to be anointed as the new king? This is one you probably don't remember. It's a guy named Hazael, H-A-Z-A-E-L. You're supposed to anoint Hazael as king of Aram. And the third assignment was to anoint Jehu as king of Israel. So far, okay? One of those has been taken care of, and Elijah is gone. So those two tasks are still hanging out there, and you need to see that. What we're going to do today has some additional very, very high points. After today, we get back down into a swamp for a while, and it may help you to have that list of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. Don't forget that they're offset in terms of time. The kings of Judah aren't going quite by quite so quickly. So you find the king of Judah here, the corresponding king of Israel is further down. If you don't have that list, see me afterwards, and I'll see if I can find you a copy. Okay, but in any event, we're going to be going back and forth between those, and it's going to be swampy. But today, we're getting into something else. Now, last time, we focused on 2 Kings 5. And in 2 Kings 5, a guy named Naaman steps onto the stage. What was Naaman's role? What was he? He was the commander of the army for the king of Aram, Israel's implacable enemy. They've been fighting back and forth. He's the commander of the army. And it says in the first little bit of 2 Kings 5, this man Naaman had been given victory, including victory over the armies of Israel, by the Lord God. The God of Israel is giving this guy and his armies power over Israel. The guy's got a problem. What's his problem? This is review of last week, so let's go quickly. He's got leprosy. He has had raiding parties going into Israel. They've captured slaves. People of Israel are now slaves, including one in his old household, a little girl from Israel who says, "Oh, that my father would simply," that's what she called my master, "would go and see the prophet of Samaria." Who's that? That's Elisha. "He would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman says to his king, the king of Aram, this is what the little servant girl said, "I'd like to go." King of Aram said, "Fine, take some presents with you and go." So he goes, shows up at the door of the king of Israel and says, "Here, I'm here to be cured of leprosy. You're supposed to do that for me." And the king of Israel says, "This is awful." But Elisha steps up and says, "Send him to me." And when he comes, he didn't do what Naaman thought he was going to do. Naaman got mad. This is what we went through last week. But at the end of the day, Naaman was humbled and cured. And he came back to give presents to Elisha, and Elisha refused them all. And what happened? Elijah's servant, Elisha, was also his apprentice to be successor after him. You think to yourself, maybe Elisha's servant might be playing the same role, although you haven't heard God giving orders for this kind of thing. Who was this guy? What was his name? Gehazi. Gehazi has seen dead people brought back to life. He has seen mighty things that Elisha has done, including the curing of leprosy. And yet, what does he succumb to?
Greed.
And what's the outcome?
Death.
Gehazi gets the leprosy. Not death. But he gets the leprosy. His family all become lepers. Okay? So, here's my question. Does Elisha still have Gehazi as a servant? The answer is I wouldn't think so. But the Bible doesn't quite tell you. And I simply want to flag that for you. Keep an eye out. Gehazi's going to show up before we finish today. But probably Elisha has another servant. It would be nice if he had a servant apprentice under God's instructions being trained to be successor after him. That doesn't seem to be the case, but in any event, keep your eyes on that. So that's where we are when we start chapter 6. There's a lost axe that Elisha finds. We're going to skip over that and jump right to verse 8. Chapter 6, 2 Kings, verse 8. What's the first thing it says?
Aram.
King of Aram is at war with
Israel.
Who's the commander of that army? Probably Naaman. We got a little conflict of interest here, don't we? We got a little conflict of interest. The king conferred with his officers and said, let's attack here, let's attack that way. And almost immediately, Elisha came to the king of Israel and said, they're going to attack this way, they're going to attack with these forces. Go meet them here. And they were defeated. And this happened over and over again until, verse 11, the king of Aram became,
what's your say?
Enraged, your says. Mine says, very much disturbed. And he says to his officers, which of you is the traitor? And the officers say,
not us,
it's Elisha. Everything you say, he knows it immediately. How did they know this? I don't know. But they did, and it was right. So, what's his plan? Verse 13, the king says, okay, find out where he is. Turns out he's at Dothan. Verse 14, what does the king do? He sent, mine says, horses and chariots, that's the cavalry, and
a
large force, yours says a great army. And these, arriving during the night, surrounded the town where Elisha was. Verse 15, next day Elisha got up early and went out, and there surrounding the town was an armed force with horses and chariots. What did Elisha say?
Don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid.
Well, you skipped something. Elisha didn't say anything yet. Who said something? His servant. Is that still Gehazi?
We don't know.
We don't know. But whoever was his servant at this time, and what does he say? Let me quote, oh my Lord, what are we going to do now? Oh my Lord, what are we to do? Question mark. Now Elisha speaks, and what does he say? Don't be afraid. And he continues to say, there's more on our side than there are on theirs. I can see the servant right now. Can you?
Really?
He turns in a circle because they're encircling the things. He says, what are you talking about? There's more on our side than on theirs. And Elisha prays. Lord, he says, open his eyes and make him see. The Lord opened the servant's eyes, and what did he see? What did he see?
The hills
full of those same fiery chariots, one of which came down to take Elisha back to heaven in the whirlwind. Mine says the mountains were covered in fiery horses and chariots surrounding Elisha. That changed everything, right? Didn't change a thing. Listen carefully. Your instinct is going to be to say, oh, that changes everything. And it doesn't. Doesn't change a thing. Why? Elisha didn't pray, God, send fiery chariots. Put them on the hills around us. What did God say? Open his eyes and let him see what's already there. It didn't change a thing. What changed was the ability of the servant to see it. But stop. This is a high point. When we can't see God's resources, and suddenly we can, it seems to change everything. It doesn't. What it changes, it changes our perspectives. We switch from making incorrect assumptions based on what we thought we was all we could see, to now having a more correct view, because now we can take things into account that we were ignoring before, or that we couldn't see before. Did that change everything? It changed nothing. What it changed was the ability of the servant to see it. So many times, for individuals, for families, and I'll hold my hand up too, we don't see what God's doing. We don't see the resources that he has available. And we come to conclusions. And sometimes, every once in a while, God, in his goodness, allows us a glimpse of those things. And it feels like everything changes. But it's more we become aligned with. We begin to see what God said. Okay? Now, we're not finished. The story now takes an interesting side turn. About this time, verse 18, the Arameans moved toward him, came down towards him. They began their attack on the little town. Elisha prayed to the Lord. What did he pray?
Blind.
Mine says, make them sun blind. I don't think yours says this. Mine has a footnote that says, and it doesn't really say this, but this is, it seems to be saying, let them be dazed for a moment to where their eyes don't work. This would describe Paul on the road to Damascus. Let them be sun blind. Strike these people sun blind. And at Elisha's word, he struck them blind or sun blind. And Elisha said to them, and I'm sorry, I apologize for this, but I keep thinking back to the very first Star Wars movie. This is not the droid you're looking for. Do you guys hear this in there? This is not the droid you're looking for, right? You have to have a certain mindset for this to work. Okay, what does Elisha say? This isn't the road you meant to be on. This isn't the town you meant to go to. Follow me, and I'll lead you to the man you're looking for. Who is the man they're looking for? The person who's speaking, but they're blind. They can't see this. So where does he lead them?
Samaria.
How far was that? How far was that? We don't have any idea. Probably far enough that by the time they get there, they're pretty tired. Right? And they're blind. They can't see anything. As they start to approach Samaria, what's in Samaria? King of Israel and the king of Israel's army. Here comes this huge force of Aramaeans coming up the road towards Samaria. Right? I'm sorry, get with me here, right? Going like this. Right? So what do the forces of Israel almost certainly do? Surround them. With swords drawn and everything else. Right? As they entered Samaria, this is verse 20, Elisha said, Lord, open these people's eyes and let them see. It's exactly the same prayer he prayed for the servant, but there's a different effect. With the servant could begin to see things of God that were not necessarily physical but spiritual. Now, these people are allowed to have their eyesight back and they can see physical things, such as a soldier an inch away with a sword at your throat ready to thrust. Are you with me so far? Is this cool or what? Verse 21. The king of Israel is standing there. And he says to Elisha, what's the term of endearment that you see here? Calls him father. Oh, father, shall I kill them? And Elisha says, kill them? Of course not. Would you kill prisoners of war? Give them something to eat, get them something to drink, and then let's send them home. And they served them a meal.
Isn't it remarkable that he asked?
Isn't it remarkable that he asked? Isn't it remarkable that he did what Elisha said? Isn't it remarkable, the whole thing? Hospitality to people who meant to kill you.
And it's not just a meal, it says a feast.
He says offer them food and water, but the king provided a great feast, mine says. The king went much further than what Elisha had said. If he'd gone to the minimum, they'd have gotten bread and water. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them off. And they went back to their master. And with what effect? What's the last little bit it says?
They stopped
sending raiding parties into Israel. And verse 24 says, but that didn't stop the battles. Because here they are coming right back with another army. Who's in charge? This is our next high point. This is our next high point. What was the first one? Open his eyes so he can see. Shall I kill them? Of course not. Let's treat them with kindness and send them home.
They had only come to get Elisha.
This time, verse 24. Verse 24, you're off on a whole new story. Who's the king of Aram?
Ben Hadad.
I think we called him Benny before. Thank you for remembering that. I'd forgotten.
Benny Hop.
Mustered his whole army. He's coming with everybody this time. Marched on and laid siege to Samaria. There's got to be a break here of some kind. Because the implication of verse 23 is that there was a peace that would have lasted a while. But here it comes back again. Who's king of Aram? Ben-Hadad or Beni-Haha. Right? Who's not king of Aram? Yet. Somebody's got it. You're stumbling for it.
The one that God said
in 1 Kings 19 is supposed to be appointed king. Who's that?
Hazael.
Hazael. Or at least that's what we're going to call him this morning. Hadad's not king yet. There's still Ben-Hadad. And he sends his whole army, and they besiege Samaria. What's the purpose of a siege? We've got airplanes now, so it doesn't work quite the same way. But back then, you had city walls, you had all kinds of things, the fortresses, the castles, and you starve them out. You cut off the water supply if you can. You cut off all the food supply. And what happens inside?
Yeah.
Starve or surrender. Die of thirst or surrender. Okay? Now, the fact that there's a siege implies they haven't surrendered so far. Okay? Why haven't they surrendered? It starts with I.
I don't know.
But let's conjecture. Let's conjecture. And while you're conjecturing, let's read a little more. Verse 25. In Samaria there was great famine. I guess there was. So strict was the siege that the head of a donkey sold for 80 shekels. I'm told that's several days' wages, maybe a week's wages. Would you like to eat that? And then it says in my translation, a quarter cab of wild onions sold for 5 shekels, but I'm willing to bet a lot that says something interestingly different in yours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does it say something interestingly different in yours?
Dung.
You could cook if you had some dung. They used to cook over cow dung. All they've got is lark dung or pigeon dung or dove dung. Or maybe this is wild onions and they can't quite figure out what a word means. But in any event, prices for food were through the roof for just next to nothing. I don't really want to do this, but I feel compelled to do that. If you go back through the television listings for this past week, you will see an absolutely stupid show on which there must be stupid contestants because they're on that show, and they're being asked to eat something worse than this. I'm fortunate I did not go look at the show, but it went running by my notice at one point over the week, and I thought to myself, boy, there's a show I'm not going to watch. But you know, you're eating the grossest and most awful of stuff, and you're paying a fortune for it. That's how bad. They're trying to get you to see how bad the siege was. This doesn't translate well, but the idea translates well, I think. Verse 26 to 31 is where this goes. Verse 26, the king was passing along a city wall. A woman shouted, "Help, my lord king, help me." "If the Lord doesn't help you," he retorted, "where can I find help for you? From the threshing floor," that's where the food might be. "From the wine press," that's where something to drink might be. And the king then asked, "What's the matter?" And when you read, this is about as grisly as it ever gets. Cannibalism has come. And the woman said, "We each have a son, my friend and I. We agreed we'd eat my son today. And then we ran out of that food, we'd eat her son. It's time to eat her son, and she's hidden him. I need you to help her bring that son back so we can eat." And at that point, the king rips open his kingly robes, his wonderful, resplendent robes, and underneath he's wearing sackcloth. Jim Pardue preached one of the most powerful sermons I ever remember being preached in this church about the king. Sackcloth. The king is in the kind of grief and mourning that precedes going to God. That's sackcloth and ashes is where you go as the first step towards going to God. And he did way more with that than I ever could. But somewhere back in there, he preached a powerful sermon on this. This is not a good king. This is a bad king. And you're going to hear Elisha confirm that very, very soon. But even he realizes the only hope we have is the Lord. So at the end of this, verse 30, he tore his clothes. Underneath, he was wearing sackcloth. Verse 31, "May the Lord bring unnameable ills on me and worse ills too, if" what? Elisha? Why does he want to kill Elisha? Can you figure this out? What did I have you pondering just a few moments ago? Why are they still in a siege? Why didn't they surrender? Can you figure it out now? Elisha's been saying, trust the Lord. Trust the Lord. Don't give in. When we get into this swamp I told you about, every time an invading army comes in, they say, "Here, take my children as slaves," the king says. "Here, take the gold and silver out of the temple that's dedicated to God's service. Just take it and leave us alone." And more and more of this stuff goes out. But Elisha has said to him, trust the Lord. trust the Lord. And here's how bad things have come. He's blaming Elisha for that. Verse 32. Elisha was sitting in his house. The elders, it doesn't say what elders, were sitting with him. The king sent a messenger ahead. But before the man arrived, Elisha said to the elders, "Do you see how this son of a murderer has given orders to cut off my head?" Son of a murderer, what does that say? This guy's bad and his daddy was worse. This guy's bad and his daddy was worse. Who was this guy's daddy? Can you figure out where we were? That's Ahab. This is Ahab's son we're talking about. "Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door, hold the gourd against him." And then Elisha adds, "But don't I hear the sound of his master's step behind him?" This is the king showing up right behind the messenger. He was actually still speaking. This is verse 33. "When the king arrived, and the king says, 'This misery plainly comes from the Lord. Why should I still trust in the Lord?'" Do you remember Job? Job is sitting in his misery. His wife comes to him and says, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" And what's the first thing Job says? "I've taken good things from the hand of the Lord. Shouldn't I take evil things as well? If he's the one offering them." And then a little bit later, I think it was Job who said, "Though he slay me, yet shall I worship him." It may have been David, but I think it was Job. Do you hear the difference between these two responses? This is all coming from the Lord. Why should I trust him anymore? Job says, "I accept good from him. When he decides evil is to be my lot for a while, shouldn't I accept that as well? Good things come, bad things come, I still praise the Lord. I still trust the Lord." Did you hear Travis say in the morning service the difference between belief and trust? There's a wonderful story Pardee used to tell. Guy walked a tightrope across, maybe across Niagara Falls. Maybe that was where it was. And he got finished, and a great crowd had gathered, and he shouted to the crowd, "Do you think I can go back across with somebody in a wheelbarrow?" And they all said, "Oh, yeah, oh, yeah." And he points to the guy and says, "How about you? You want to get in the wheelbarrow?" Same kind of thing. Okay. Verse 1. Elisha is still responding to the king. And what does he say? "Listen to the word of the Lord." Elisha is now no longer speaking, but quoting what God has said to say. "The Lord says this, 'By this time tomorrow, a measure,'" I'm told that's not a scoop, that's more like a barrel, "'of the finest flour will sell for one shekel, and two measures of barley for one shekel at the gates of Samaria.'" Verse 2, it says the king was leaning on the arm of one of his servants. My translation calls him the equerry. Does yours have a title for the servant, or does it just say servant?
The officer.
Officer, yours says officer. Officer, I think, is not bad, especially when you put it with equerry. What does equerry imply? It has to do with horses. This may be the commander of the chariot forces, or it may be the person who makes sure that all of those... If you've ever... Some of you know we have a person in our church who used to fly fighter planes for the U.S. Air Force. The tech sergeants that keep those planes in operation just before they go become really important. And the person who's in charge of all of those, it might be somebody like that. He blurts out, but to Elisha, not to the king, "Even if the Lord made windows in the sky, how could this word come true?" And Elisha replies, "You're going to see it, but you're not going to taste a bit of it." And if you're that person, what do you hear? "I'm going to see something and then I'm going to die." There's the prophecy. Now, the scene shifts. Where is he going? Are you going to find that flour selling for a shekel? Where are you going to find that barley selling for a shekel? The gates of Samaria. The scene shifts to the gates of Samaria. What do the gates of Samaria look like at this point? Closed. It's a siege, right? The gates are closed. Elisha, the king, and all the people are inside, but there's four guys outside. Why are they outside the gate? They've got leprosy. And they're sitting there debating. "We got a choice. We can stay here and starve, Or we can go down to the Aramean camp, and beg. They'll probably kill us. But maybe we'll get a little food before we die. They're certainly not going to let us back in here. And so, off they go to the Aramean camp. And what do they find? No people. Now, in between, the Bible explains to you what happened. The Lord caused the Arameans in their camp to hear the noise of chariots and horses, the noise of a great army. And they all said to one another, "Listen to that! The king of Israel has hired the Hittites and the Egyptians to attack us." And in the dusk, they made off and fled. They ran for their lives, abandoning their tents, their horses, their donkeys, leaving the camp just as it was as they fled for their lives. And the men, verse 8, with leprosy, reached the confines of the camp, went into one of the tents, and ate and drank. They took all the gold and silver they could find, went out and hid it, some clothes with it too. Came back, found another tent, ate and drank, took the silver and gold out, hid that. And about that time, look carefully, see if I'm right. It wasn't one of them said this. It was they all started saying it to each other at that moment. And this is the highest point of the day. What do they say? We are doing evil. This is a day of, my translation, this is not an accident. This is a day of good news. And we are holding our tongues. If we wait till morning, we will deserve to be punished. Let's go now and take the good news to the palace. And off they went and shouted out to the guards on the city gate. We've been to the Aramean camp. There was not a soul there, not even a sound of anyone. All we found was tethered horses and tethered donkeys and their tents just as they were. The gatekeeper shouted the news, and this was reported inside the palace. And the king got up when it was still dark and said to his officers, "It's a trap. We're not going to fall for that. They're just trying to get us outside where they can trap us." And some of his officers said something smart. What did they say? "We've got 5 horses that aren't going to live another day. Let's send them out with a party of soldiers and just see what's out there." So they opened the gates long enough for them to go, and what did they find? Just as the lepers had said. Verse 16. The people went out and plundered the Aramean camp, and a measure of finest flour sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for 1 shekel, just as the Lord had promised. The king had sent the equerry to stand at the gate and manage the traffic. Verse 20, and what happened? He was trampled in the stampede and died. What's that central message? God has given me good news. God has given you good news. How can you keep it to yourself? Beggars telling other beggars where to find the food. And this is almost literally that. That's the story. There's a little epilogue. First part of verse of chapter 8. And I think this epilogue actually jumps you way back. I think it jumps you way back. Mine starts out in chapter 8, verse 1. Elisha had said, sometime in the past, to whom? To the woman whose son he had raised from the dead, raised to life, mine says, "Move away with your family and live where you can in some foreign country, for the Lord has called up a famine. It's already on the way. It's already coming on the country, and it's going to be here for 7 years." And the woman hurried to do what the man of God had told her. She set out, she and her family, and for 7 years she lived in Philistine territory. When the 7 years were over, which I think now is now up past the siege, things are back. She comes back and makes a claim for her house and her land. What would happen if she abandons her house and her land? Somebody's going to take it over. So somebody else is there. She's come back to file a claim with the king. It doesn't mention her husband, but it also doesn't mention her son. It just says her family in my translation. Does that match yours? So that implies that husband's still there, but she's the one that Elisha is working with. Verse 4, the king was talking to who? Who is Gehazi, it says. What does it say?
Servant of the man of God.
Now, is he still the servant of the man of God, or is this somebody who used to be? Is this somebody we call president or governor or senator who isn't anymore, or is this somebody who still is? We don't know. But in any event, the king was saying to him, tell me some more about all the marvels that Elisha did. And Gehazi was just telling him about raising this boy from the dead when the woman lodged her claim. My lord king, Gehazi said, that's the woman I was just talking about. The king heard her claim, sent officers with her to see that all her property was restored and that she would get back the revenue that her land had produced during the time that she was away. Strange little epilogue. It was almost like this particular family was spared all the pain, turmoil, and all this, then was restored for their faithfulness. What are the highlights that we saw this time? What are the highlights that we saw this time? There's more on our side than there are on theirs. What do you mean? Open his eyes so he can see. The giving of hospitality to people who meant to kill you. The fact that even an evil king knows how to go into godly mourning in preparation for meeting the Lord. The fact that somebody can say, this has come from the Lord, and maybe it has, so why should I trust him anymore? Try to make that connection with Job, who saw something of a higher path. And then finally, this little bit. Now, we got just time to do one more thing. Chapter 8, verse 7. We got two minutes. Chapter 7, 2 Kings 8. First three or four words are stunning. What does yours say? Elisha went to Damascus, to the capital city of the country whose king had wanted to kill him and tried to kill him twice. Wow. When he gets there, Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, was ill. He was told, the man of God has come all this way to meet with us. And so the king said to, drum roll please, Haziel, go consult the man of God. Take presents with you. It turns out presents are sufficient to load 40 camels. Take presents with you and ask him if I will survive. So Haziel goes to Elisha and he says, the king, your son Ben-Hadad, this is the tail end of verse 9, king of Aram has sent me to ask you, shall I recover from my illness? And Elisha says, you go tell him you might recover. But the truth is, God has shown me he's going to certainly die. And then the face of the man of God went rigid and his look grew strangely fixed. And he began to weep. Why, Haziel asked, does my Lord weep? And Elisha says, because I know what harm you will do to the Israelites. You will burn down their fortresses, put their picked warriors to the sword, dash their little children to pieces, disembowel their pregnant women. But what is your servant? Haziel replies. How could this dog achieve anything so great? Elisha replied, in a vision from the Lord, I have seen you, king of Aram. Haziel goes back to Ben-Hadad, who says, what did the man of God say? And he says, the man of God says, you'll certainly recover. And when the king went to sleep, he waterboarded him. Take a close look. Do you see it? Do you see it? Except he didn't survive the waterboarding. Who's king now? And the second of the commands is now fulfilled. What's left? Jehu to become king of Israel. It's going to get bloodier. It's going to get swampy. The high places are going to be harder to find. But today is full of them. We are doing evil. God has given us good news and we're not sharing it. That I think may be the highest. Lord, open their eyes so they can see. Because all they're seeing are the obstacles. All they're seeing are the dangers. They're not seeing your resources. Or, Yeah, I know you wanted to kill me. You meant it to me for evil. But God meant it to me for good. Sit down and have something to eat. Let me send you on your way with God's blessings. I see risk over almost everything in sight. But I also see some pretty big things God's trying to tell us. We'll start next time, chapter 8, verse 16. May God bless you until that day. Let's pray. Our Father, I thank you for the time you've given us. I thank you for these good people who meet here so regularly. I thank you for the opportunity you give us to study your word. And I pray today you would put a word in the heart of each person so that we can know more of you and begin to see things that otherwise we might not be able to see if we are not standing close to you. Teach us how to be hospitable to people who do not wish us well. Teach us how to see your path, even if it goes through hard country. For we pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.